linguistic art chicks.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. And I have to tell you that as I was getting ready to record this podcast just now, I felt like maybe I was Rip Van Winkle or somebody just waking up from a long sleep and discovering that a lot of time has passed without me noticing. What I'm talking about is that for the past 10 days, I've more or less ignored the world while I'm in the final stages of recording my audiobook. And when I poked my head back up and checked my email, I discovered that so many donors had made contributions to the salon that I was sure it must be December already and that it was Christmas time. Wait till you hear this list of donors. And they are John A., our old friend, A Dime Short. Thanks again, Michael. Jason H., SMD Books, who I notice happens to be located in Paris, so you Parisian saloners now know where to find a few of the others. And we also received another donation from my fellow grandfather, Robert O., and thank you again for your longtime support, Robert. And we also received three generous donations, one from Jarrett S., one from someone who would rather remain completely anonymous, so thank you, Anon. And the third one came from Wiley L., who is a longtime friend that I haven't seen since we were last together in Palenque. Wow, you guys have all really outdone yourselves this time. I simply don't know what to say. And I'd also like to thank Steve and Julie and you other wonderful saloners for your cool cards and notes. I wish there was time to send out personal thank yous to everyone who sends in a donation or a card or email, but I do want you to know that everything any of our saloners do to help spread the word about the psychedelic community is greatly appreciated by me and by all of our fellow psychonauts around the world. It's a wonderful community that we are all a part of. So, now that we've found some of the others, let's get to work here and get on with the program. At the end of today's podcast, I'll give you an update on the archival preservation work that is being done for the Shulgin and Stolaroff papers, and there is a lot of good news on that front. So, in the spirit of preserving archival material, I thought it might be appropriate once again to dip into the Timothy Leary archives and pull out another one of his pioneering talks. What I'm going to play for us to hear right now is an interview that Dr. Leary gave in 1983. And this is from a cassette tape in his archive that was labeled New Dimensions, featuring Tim Leary, recorded in 1983. And thanks to Bruce Damer and Dennis Berry, the woman who is responsible for this huge archive, all of the audio and video recordings that Timothy saved are being digitized and released to the Internet via the Internet Archive, which you can find at archive.org, and through these podcasts here in the Psychedelic Salon. Now, you're going to find this interview a little different in that it begins more like what our young saloners would call a history lesson and what grandpas like Robert O. and I think of more as a stroll down memory lane. But I think that these stories are very important right now because we are entering another period of great instability, not unlike the 60s, I might add. And so if we know what some people did in the past at another time of great cultural upheaval, if we know what worked and what didn't work, well, then it seems to me that we have an excellent chance of ratcheting our species up yet another notch on our evolutionary climb out of the swamp. At least that's my rationale for indulging myself by playing what I think is a really interesting interview. And now, here is Dr. Timothy Leary back in 1983, when the big news was that Lotus 1-2-3 had just been ported to the then-new IBM PC, and Ronald Reagan had just begun his horrible reign. And it was about 10 years before we had the World Wide Web. You remember those times, don't you? I think they were called the Dark Ages.
I'd like to enter a time machine, if we will. Go back 20 years. Go back to Harvard. And if you can put yourself back in that place. I'm wondering, at that time, what was your vision of the future? What did you see, what you were doing then? Did you see it taking Where did you see it going? What was your future idea of its direction, the work you were doing?
I think that from the very beginning of our psychedelic drug research at Harvard, we knew that we were on the verge of something very big. We knew that human intelligence and human virtue had reached a point where we would be able to learn more about the brain and activate it. Of course, those of us at Harvard, Richard Alpert, Baba Ram Dass, Ralph Metzner, the large group that assembled there, were not the pioneers, the people that were teaching us about consciousness expanding drugs were people like Aldous Huxley, Alan Watts, even Henry Luce, the respectable conservative founder of Time magazine. There was a large group of thoughtful people who told us that the doors of perception were going to open and an avalanche of change would happen. So there was never any doubt in our minds that we were members of an old profession. And this happened before. It happened in the 1830s. There was a transcendental movement, which again started at Harvard. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Thoreau, Margaret Fuller, the first great woman transcendentalist. That explosive movement of Brook Farm. But, of course, it goes way back. If you want to take the time tunnel, the concepts that we were working with, which is altered states, consciousness expansion, increased intelligence, finding divinity and finding illumination, revelation within, it goes back throughout human history. So we were, with the aid of people like Alan Watts and Aldous Huxley, we were pretty clear that we were and certain that we were riding a Niagara wave.
Well, what happened with respect to the institution in the sense, I mean, did you become too successful and suddenly it wasn't appropriate to be a part of the institution anymore, or did you, or was it somehow become threatening all of a sudden? What took place there when Harvard essentially asked you to leave and you departed?
It became clear to us that the sort of research we were doing, which involved radically different ways of approaching the brain and the mind, couldn't and shouldn't be done in a prestigious, respectable, highly establishment organization like Harvard University. So actually, several weeks before Richard and I were fired, I had left Harvard. I'd turned in my time clock and headed for Mexico, where we'd started a training center. We knew that we shouldn't be at Harvard, and we had no and never have had any grudges about Harvard. Goodness, Harvard is there to train Ivy Leaguers to go to Washington and Wall Street and keep the WASP establishment going. They're supposed to be turning out new Buddhas and a new brand of science fiction neuronauts.
So it was just sort of a natural thing.
Yes, occurred. There was a little drama involved in it. In flashbacks, I mentioned some of the minor political squabbling. There was a professor there named Herbert Kelman who kind of led an attack on us, and turned out later that he was a beneficiary of CIA funding. He says he wasn't winning, but that doesn't make any difference. The CIA knew they had a good, sound fellow there that should be rewarded. So that there were political issues, but they're secondary. They're kind of gossipy, but we didn't belong at Harvard, and we set up our own institutions. Throughout history, that's been true. You know, Freud couldn't get a job in a Viennese hospital, and Socrates got put in the last cell in the back row and of death row, and Voltaire had to head it on the lam. We were pretty much aware, I think all of us at the Harvard psychological group, and that included about 35 of us, people like Professor Walter Clark, who was a very distinguished, gray, ultra-respectable theologian. The younger psychologists, too, they knew they were risking their careers. They knew that they were maybe going to put themselves out a little too far and never be able to get back. But we always had a sense of history. Allen Ginsberg, I have a chapter in Flashbacks about Allen Ginsberg coming to Harvard. And Allen and people like Kerouac and Burroughs taught us a great deal, too. They had the street wisdom that we lacked, being Ivy League Harvard professors. And Allen Ginsberg, whatever you think of his poetry, is a very effective literary social worker. He's like a cosmic defense attorney for beatniks and romantics and bohemians and hippies and hipsters, no matter what name you give them. The group in every culture throughout history that have carried on the message of individuality, look within, irreverence to authority, question authority, try something new. Ginsberg was very aware. Ginsberg told me, and I've thought about it almost every week since then, that we were part of the bohemian tradition or of the avant-garde tradition that had always existed, and he felt that our group included Gary Snyder, it included Ken Kesey. He saw us as important historically as Plato, Aristotle, Socrates. And we're a young country, and we've only been going 200 years. And I think when the history of our times is written, you're never going to hear the names of Nixon or Kissinger or MacArthur. Or, you know, you may make some mention of Roosevelt, maybe Kennedy because of the assassination of the romance. But the Allen told us, and I believe him, and I'll repeat it today, that I think that the history of America is going to be the history of people like Emerson, Thoreau, Jefferson as a philosopher. Edgar Allan Poe, my God, that poor man was savaged by the media and pushed around by the establishment. Mark Twain, who was a tremendous outcast, even though he was very popular. The history of America is the history of those of us that belong to this this wonderful brotherhood and sisterhood of avant-garde inner voyagers. That we believe that we're the American tradition. And so we weren't really that surprised when the thing exploded in the 60s. We that's what we had signed up for.
I recall something in the book you mentioned about Aldous Huxley, and I believe there was somebody else whose name I can't recall, and Aldous was saying that he thought you were a little too conservative in your approach.
Yes, that Humphrey Osmond.
That's it, Humphrey Osmond.
The brilliant British psychiatrist who invented the word psychedelic. Had been conspiring with Huxley, and the two of them came to Harvard, and they kind of checked me out, and they were hoping that we would do pretty much what we did. I think we probably carried a little too far, or events carried all of us farther than we expected. But Huxley and Osmond, after the dinner with me, went, "Well, he's a nice guy, but he's a little too straight, and maybe we can loosen him up."
And you mentioned Allen Ginsberg. He had this idea of traipsing off to New York on weekends and turning on as many of his associates and friends as possible. And there were some fascinating stories that you related in the book about those kind of those experiences.
Well, as I say, Allen has always been a politician, a cosmic politician. He was the first person to point out to me the insanity and cruelty of the drug laws, treating people as criminals for trying to alter their conscience. He was a tremendous crusader, and always has been. Anytime anyone was in jail, God knows how many times Allen bailed me out or got signatures and petitions to help me out of the various dungeons that the establishment put me in. So Allen said that our strategy should be one of turning on important people in literature and poetry, art, music. So he had, I remember it was about 21 years ago today in my dining room, he pulled out his battered leather address book, and there in his tiny little Ginsberg scrawl, he had the names and addresses and phone numbers of the who's who of American art. And then he'd give me a ring and in the middle of the week, and I'd go down from Logan Airport on the Boston to New York shuttle with my little bag full of psilocybin pills, and Peter Luskin, Al, and I would go around New York turning on the famous, distinguished, successful people in the arts. The idea was that if we turned them on, they could tell us what they experienced because we were novices. They could in turn teach other people about this, and we thought that the movement would grow that way, and certainly did.
Timothy, if you were back in the 60s now, would you do anything differently than you did then?
Oh, Michael, that's, of course, the big if question. Wouldn't we all do it differently if we could do it, you know, if you go back to your senior prom? It would, I've given this a great deal of thought, and I've been asked that question many times. Basically, we were out there doing our best on a frontier that had never been explored before. Our hearts were pure, and on the big issues, we always did the right thing. One thing I kind of regret is that we were a little blind. I didn't understand the importance of the new generation. I didn't realize demography, that there were 76 million kids born between the years 46, that's post-Hiroshima, and 1964. Double the birth rate. 40 million more than we expected. Now, the impact of doubling a birth rate in a country like America is simply enormous. And, of course, this generation was not only different in size, it was different in their basic reality imprints. As parents of this generation, it was Dr. Spock. It was demand feeding. It was treat them equals. Treat them as individuals. Don't force them into a role. That had never been done before to kids. That's almost unheard of. And when the right-wing reactionary and left-wing reactionary people later on blamed Dr. Spock, you know, they were right. It was, of course, Dr. Spock was simply a vehicle, an instrument for genetic history unfolding. But this, we hotshots at Harvard and we philosophy PhDs really didn't understand that this generation was going to sweep through American culture like a tsunami wave, changing everything, including us. And it just swept us right out of Harvard, and it swept us right out of any illusions we might have had of slow change. I think that if we caught on to this quicker, we probably would have warned people in the late 60s that the LSD they were getting was not pure, and that there was a deliberate government conspiracy to kind of cloud up and put out really dangerous drugs. I think that we didn't understand the enormity of implications of the baby boom. And I personally now feel that the concept of generation, the generation you belong to, is one of the most important things in your life, because you're going to be swimming like a school of fish in this school of your own generation. And the kids that came up in the 60s, hit high school and college in the 60s and early 70s, share basic reality imprints that are entirely different from Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill and even Teddy Kennedy. And the reason that the importance of generational demographics, generational psychology, the reason we didn't understand it was because there had never in history been such a quick generational change of that import and that numbers, the baby boom. So in hindsight, if I knew then what I know now, I probably would have done something differently, but you can't...
What about your perception of the establishment? I mean, in some sense, in talking about being out on the edge, you were out on the farthest edge. And have you ever thought that perhaps you took the rap for a lot of other people? Since, I mean, you got nailed and many other people didn't.
Well, I was very aware of that, and I think most thoughtful people were aware of that in the after Nixon came into power in 1968. It's obvious he couldn't do anything about young people and the counterculture and drugs, but one thing he could do would be, and he said it in so many words, we can imprison the spokesman. So I knew that I was like a lightning rod. I knew that I was like a symbol. And I accepted this. It's reality, and you can't complain about it, or you can't cry foul. That's the way the ball game is played, and that's why I've never felt any resentment or bitterness. Matter of fact, I'm rather honored. I was put in the penalty box in the great cosmic hockey game for 4 years. Well, they put in the penalty box the people they think are most dangerous to them, and in a sense, that it's flattering. So.
Do you think in reflecting on that experience that the establishment learned anything from their experience with you? And if so, what?
No, the establishment never learns anything. They'd start Vietnam again, as they're trying to do in Central America. Vietnam was, of course, the Korean War. They never learn anything. They're always fighting the last war because you can't learn. Once you've been imprinted in adolescence, unless you deliberately try to re-imprint and change, you can't learn. You're simply going to repeat the same reactions because you're living in the same reality. Tip O'Neill in Ronald Reagan's 60s was Teddy Roosevelt running around storming Cuba and running down with a big stick in the Caribbean and shaking his fist at Nicaragua and stealing the Panama Canal away from the country of Colombia. So that, they still see the world in those terms, and they can't be expected to change. And I'm not being hostile here. It's a straight neurological fact we're talking about.
What allows some people to re-imprint and change and others not?
Well, that's a good question. I think where you hang out is very important. I think the people that you associate with. The problem with Ronald Reagan right now is that he probably spends less than 2 or 3% of his time with kids under the age of 18. He simply never hangs out with them. And if he does, it's not in any sense of learning from them, you know, to perform. So I'd say really zero. He's getting no input from the whiz kids. I think he spends almost no time with baby boomers, those now between the age of 18 and 36. He may see them occasionally, but it's to give a speech at at an organization. But to really sit down, hang out, listen, absorb, learn, exchange, interface, get it on with, and that the only way you can learn, these people don't, and they get trapped in their realities, and of course it's true the Soviet people that run the Soviet Union and China too, look at their faces, it's so simple too, if you want to change, it's just it's geography. Just move to the place where different people hang out and listen. And right now, I spend about 60% of my time with people between the ages of 18 and 36. My wife comes from this group, and most of our friends are. I spend about 20%, maybe 25% of my time with kids born after 64. This is my 9-year-old son, my 10-year-old granddaughter, my 11-year-old grandson. I hang out, listening to them, playing computers with them, and I spend less than 10% of my time with people of my own generation. I can play. I see very clearly that the age of the people you hang out with determines your age, and it's possible just as you have geographical units like continents like Asia and Africa and Ireland. Generations are temporal units, and you can jump generations. You can migrate. And how do you migrate from one generation to another? It's time travel. Just hang out with people of different ages. And I like to take trips way back to the 1920s. I can talk World War II. I can talk alcohol prohibition with the old-timers, and I love to do it, but not more than 10% of the time.
We heard about the 60s being the revolutionary generation, the revolutionary decade, and the 70s being the me decade. And what do you think is the legacy of the 60s? Because most of that really is media hype. I mean, it's really not an accurate reflection of what happened.
Well, I think it's a mistake to focus on the decade. You must keep your eye on that generation. The baby boom generation, those born between the years 1946 and 64, the late 60s and early 70s, was their adolescence. So it was romantic, idealistic. They wanted to shake up and change sexual mores, music, art, lifestyle, you name it. Anything in the broad spectrum of American culture was changed by these kids then. Now, the 70s was a period when they were settling down into graduate school. They were they were settling down to careers. They were having families. The 80s, period when this group is getting to a position where they're going to take over. You see, in 1988, there'll be an election then, I hope. The baby boomers, 76 million of them, will be between the ages of 24 and 42. So we're talking here about this generation is basically a 21st century generation. And instead of using the term baby boom, I sometimes prefer to use the concept the 21st century generation, because at the turn of the century, the baby boomers are between the ages of 36 and 54. They'll have it's their generation. It's their century. They're not really of this century. So they're going to, in the future, step by step, they're going to take over. And I tell you, they are different, and they're going to make America a different and a much better country.
Do you think psychedelics are necessary for change, for people to change, to re-imprint, as it were?
Yes, I think that now, this period, I would be amazed if anyone would explain to me how they can really change the neurological imprint without using the organic chemicals that are... See, a drug that changes your brain is an access code, like those circuits of your computer. Drugs interface or interconnect or unlock receptor sites in the brain. Now, there are other ways of doing this. Dr. Patterson apparently has developed this electrical way of setting up vibrations to set off endorphins and so forth. I'm sure that in the future we will have other ways of doing this.
The Buddhists would say they have other ways of doing it, for example.
Good for them. Yeah. There's really no cause for debate here. Anyone who really... if you think of the endpoints that you want to get to, and that anything that will get you there is it's your style and your way of doing it.
In some sense, if one looks at other cultures and other societies, particularly... more societies that would fit the definition of primitive, or perhaps using the word primal, and not using primitive in the sense that it's ordinarily used as being backwards or not civilized or whatever. But if one looks at primitive societies, one notices that frequently they have ritualized events in their lives where they use natural drugs to change their consciousness in order to deal with various aspects of their life. And in this society, we don't seem to have any such ritual other than perhaps the stand-up cocktail party, and not much more than that.
Well, it is interesting how alcohol has got so much ritual. You know, you walk into a bar room at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the afternoon, it's like a cathedral with the glass and the bottles and the lights and the priest is the bartender's white uniform and the clinks and the laughter and the merriment of people who have just gotten off work and want to flirt and want to relax. It's an incredibly powerful ritual that has nothing to do with alcohol. But one, I hesitated when you asked me about, did I think drugs were necessary, and kind of pause for this reason. You have to ask about any consciousness-altering technique, what's the goal? Instead of talking about this form of meditation or that, this drug or that, what are you trying to get? What is the end state? Because after all, it's not the drug or the technique, although we quarrel and imprison each other and divide up and debate over the technique issue. The basic issue is, where do we want to get? And I don't think we can discuss consciousness or drugs at this moment in world history without realizing that we are changing from an industrial society to an information society, and the awesome implications of this. And obviously, the use of drugs, the fact that, in America today, $90 billion is spent on illegal drugs alone. $90 billion, that's like 20 times more than the entire output of Hollywood in a year. And that's just illegal drugs. That doesn't include the legal drugs like alcohol and nicotine and prescription drugs. The reason for this is not that society is going to hell or that it's the fall of the Roman Empire. It's we're moving into an information society when a communication and when neurological input-output and expansion of receptors and in better techniques of storing and transmitting information. These are the real issues. And naturally, drugs which alter consciousness, which change your processing of information, are going to be more part of life than in a industrial. In an industrial society, you couldn't possibly have a big drug movement which involved individual search or individual personal development. Why? Because everyone had to be there at the factory at 8 o'clock when that whistle went off, and you had to work right on your job until 5, and you had to punch that clock, and you had to be dependable, reliable, replaceable, conforming. Now, you couldn't have a personal growth, internal introspection, meditation, psychedelic type movement in an industrial society. So what we call the 60s and the me generation, the self-development, personal growth movement of the 70s, and to me, the 80s are kind of like the really hip, sophisticated hipster generation. I think I do a lot of lecturing, Michael, at colleges, and I talk, you know, to young people. I listen to them. They're not conservative. They're basically realistic. I think they're very sophisticated, and I think they understand the 60s, they understand the 70s, and they're not waving flags, but I think that they're basically, they've got a certain cynical, tolerant, amused wisdom here that I think is going to be quite appropriate for the information society that we're generating. And I must say at this point that the use of brain change drugs or of consciousness altering techniques has got to be tied in to the use of computers. I've been working with and around computers and computer people for the last 2 years, and I'm not the first person to say this, it's almost a cliche, but computers are the 80s what brain change drugs were the 60s and early 70s. You know, you talk to people and they say, well, I use a computer because it saves time or because it's more efficient. That's not the issue. A computer is an extension of the human brain, and you can program computers. I'm working now with a group that are programming computers to think like selves. So you'd have a program which would have a personality, and we're trying to program computers to evolve and to grow. And if we can train a computer to do that, then, of course, it's going to be a lot more respectable and a lot easier for the whole society to accept these concepts of personal growth and development.
And program computers so that we don't need ourselves anymore.
That's the question. See, the use of humanauts, that's advanced artificial intelligence computers and robots, raises the question, you know, we don't need human beings to work anymore. Matter of fact, work should be stricken from our vocabulary. In a sense, work is slavery. Work is something that you have to do. Now, any work that you have to do that can be done better by a machine, of course, is humiliating. But the question is, if computers and robots can help us evolve and grow, what do we need? What are humans for? Isn't that wonderful? Finally, we're not here to fight communism. We're not here to fight for a job. We don't do that anymore. What are we for? Well, the answer to that is, the function of the human being is to evolve, to grow, to become more intelligent, to become a more advanced form of our species. And it's exactly that moment when computers and robots are teaching us, are acting as catalysts to stimulate us to make the next evolutionary move. I go around now and I watch everything's being done by human beings. Could this be done better by a highly, you know, an artificial intelligent robot? And the embarrassing answer is 90% of the times you're having some trouble with a clerk or a reservations clerk or whatever it is, or the job could be done more efficiently.
That leads me to a question I'd like to ask you, Timothy, particularly with the emergence of the computer in the 80s and the technology that allows us to have this incredible abundance of information. We have this paradox of this abundant information and informational sources, and we have this shortage of wisdom.
Yep.
As you just pointed out, in the fact that frequently we have human beings could perhaps their jobs could be better done by robots, mostly because there isn't an appropriate application of wisdom mm-hmm. in the process of interacting with people. What about that paradox? Are computers going to give us wisdom?
Yeah, you could buy within 5 years, 3 years, maybe 2 years, you'll be able to buy a wisdom programs like Pac-Man. It would probably cost $35, $39. It'd be the wisdom program. Teach you how to be wise. And it would stimulate you. And you could play games with it. And any time you slid off and started to be unwise, the computer would say, oh, no, come on now. You're supposed to be wise. It's, oh, yeah. There is this paradox. But I think we must be very kind to each other. We're involved in such an accelerated rate of revolution right now, and things are happening so quickly. My goodness, every 5 years there's almost a new wave of innovation that's happening. And
5 years is more like 5 weeks.
I agree. Eight at the truth, I know. So that now, the problem is, of course, that the men, and I use the male gender here quite precisely, the men who are running America go back. They're the coal warriors, they're the hawks, they're the people who were imprinted before 1946, they still believe in American Legion. They still believe in empire. They still believe in guns and
peace through strength, I think.
Yeah, that's the idea. They are still in charge and will remain in charge for the next two or perhaps 6 years. And the last thing in the world they're interested in is an increase in intelligence or increase in wisdom. But they'll be phasing out very quickly. And I may be overly optimistic, but I believe that the younger generation, those born between 46 and 64, are going to make a difference. They do think differently. And if I'm optimistic and if I'm wrong, I'm going to go around the country and I'm going to talk to several million people in the next two or three years saying exactly this message. 76 million of you, you've got to be different. You simply have the numerical power, and I'm going to make it happen. If I have to go to
Well, we're fond of saying around here that optimism is a biological necessity.
Oh, boy, yeah. The word optimism, very interesting. It comes from the Latin optimus, which means, the best. And pessimist comes from the Latin word pessimus, which means worst. And so we've simply got to demand the best from ourselves and from each other.
Timothy, I'd be interested in your perception of what you see taking place now. It seems that we're living in highly reactionary times, and it's almost as if there's this headlong rush to return to the past. There's a popularity of nostalgia, and it should be like the 50s again. And what about that? What do you think's going on?
Well, I think that in anything you say about humanity at this point should precisely indicate the age group and the geographical location. It is true that in places like Washington, D.C., there's a great deal of looking backward on the part of both the Republicans, who want us to take us back to a real glorious, wonderful war, or the Democrats, who want to somehow get back to the New Deal. And there's, on the other hand, there's an enormous amount of a fresh, new, futuristic thinking in this country. My travels have convinced me that, Michael, I think there are 20, maybe 30 million, maybe even more Americans who are reasonably enlightened. Now, they're not Buddhas, but they basically understand multiple reality. They basically have a sense of history. They have a sense of, they're basically tolerant. They basically understand what not to do. And they're waiting for something that will harness. Maybe I'm conservative. Maybe.
No, I think, well, SRI would agree with you. They've identified 21% of the American population as being interdirected.
Yeah, yeah.
And 33 million adults.
Yeah, the Yankovic poll, too, suggested that as high as 80% were partially involved in lifestyle and personal growth. But the popularity of movies like E.T. and War Games, which are totally disrespectful of authority, and young people's movies, just irreverent to the old ways. The computer movement, which the personal computer, the ability to have in your own home something that you can program and reprogram, means that Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, both of whom are, acid heads or 60s kids, have given us, they wrenched away from the mainline IBM people, this powerful tool and made it available. In the old days, most of us hated computers because we were being spindled and mutilated and cataloged and pushed around by them, but that's no longer possible. Indeed, even IBM, the great Vatican of computeries, has given in now and is leading the way to personal computers. This is important as the development of by Gutenberg of the printing press, which was a personal book before the Gutenberg. There was one mainframe book in any town owned by the cardinal or the duke. That was the Bible, and nobody could use it except the clerks or the hackers or the monks. So when Gutenberg allowed us to have the personal book, that meant we could, in our own home, we could read, and then we could start writing. We could start writing personal books and even recreational books. So the same thing was true with drugs in the 60s. The establishment had drugs, and then the idea of personal drugs and recreational drugs that you could take home and do what you wanted to. The computer is a continuation of this evolutionary history, something that frees the individual to program and reprogram and to get ahead of the system. So I'm citing here many reasons why I am optimistic, although I must agree that the Reagan administration is represents an iron triangle of the military, the Republican Party, and the big industrial, particularly the weapons makers, who definitely run things, no question of it. The Time, Life, and Coca-Cola control Hollywood. They control the country. They've even knocked out Ma Bell, wasn't it? We always thought Ma Bell owned this, but turns out it's Lifetime and Pepsi and Coca-Cola. So I have no illusions about the... I feel the men in this iron triangle, the Republican Party, the military, and the weapons people, they belong to the Puritan strain. It came over, in the first wave of from England. These men are tough-minded. They don't believe in life. They're predestinationists. Basically, they think that the world is a terrible place, and there is an elect, and you have to be belong to that WASP, and they don't care about the country, they don't care about humanity, they don't believe in evolution, basically, and they're mean, nasty, they hate play, they hate fun, they hate the idea of individual, freedom. No, I have no illusions. I'm not just preaching marshmallow fluff here and, take a joint and everything's going to be great. I think we have to be incredibly smart and we have to be incredibly effective in communicating. I'm communicating to more people, I think more effectively now than I was in the late 60s and 70s. I've got this book coming out. I think it's going to be a bestseller. God, it's very clear the establishment hate my book. See, if Time Magazine wouldn't review my book. They said they would, but they wouldn't. Now, that's really amazing. You see the stuff they review. And I finally understood why. They couldn't review that book because it's a good book about a good period, about a lot of good people doing a lot of good things. And if they were to say anything about that book, they want people to think that I'm brain damaged and I'm crazy and then my toasted head and blah, blah, blah. If they had to admit that the book was well-written and it's about important events in human history, their whole edifice, their whole structure, their whole reality would have to change. And, of course, they're not about to let that happen. So I have no illusions about the power of the men who are running things. And the Democrats, I'm giving hell to the Republicans here, but the Democrats are no help either. They haven't come out with any new ideas. But I think it's this collective intelligence that those who went through the 60s and 70s share. There's no easy answer, and I'm not selling anything except individual intelligence, collectively shared, the ability to really look at each other in the eye, and we're not going to be fooled again, as Peter Townsend sang. We're not going to follow leaders. We're going to watch our parking meters, as Dylan sang. There's a tremendous heritage of intelligence and a tremendous confidence that we that went through the 60s and 70s share. And when the time comes, I don't think there's going to be a leader either. We're beyond hierarchies and messiahs. There's not going to be a swami or a holy person. God help us. It's going to be networks. It's going to be local groups. It's going to be communications. It's going to be computer linkages. It's going to be interfaces that a communication society can set up. It's going to be intelligence expressed and shared. And we're going to see that our task is to activate and stimulate each other to grow and change. And it's going to require a lot of intelligence. It's not going to require work and struggle. It's not those old political notions. It's going to require sharp sparkling-eyed link-up, and I believe it's going to happen.
So you think we're going to survive the nuclear era where we have this incredible proliferation of nuclear weapons? You think we're going to come through it unscathed?
Well, who knows? I don't know any more than anyone else. I have my own scenario. Number one, I believe that you've got to think positively, and you've got to do everything in your power to stop a nuclear. So I believe in nuclear activism. I believe in the freeze movement. I think that we should all vote this year. I haven't voted in years, but I'm going to register, and my wife Barbara and I are going to vote. We're encouraging young people to vote because, God, 76 million of you, you got the power. Yes, I'm basically realistically and scientifically optimistic. I think if we can hold on till 1988, the baby boom generation will elect officers, an administration, who shall be realistic and will simply say to the rest, well, listen, we don't want to have the Cold War anymore. It's unrealistic to do that. And we'll do everything in our power to make the Soviet Union feel secure without, of course, disarming ourselves. We'll keep the concept of Spaceship America or Fortress America. I'll even buy that. But we're going to pull back. We're not going to fight you in Afghanistan. We're not going to surround you with all those. We're going to do everything in our power, realistically, to make Russians feel secure. And we're going to tell the rest of the world we simply aren't going to go on with this insanity, because the Cold War, the men that are running it, Reagan and Weinberger and Haig and Kissinger, you know, they are certifiably lunatic. They really have taken leave of their senses. They're out of touch with reality. They're playing out boys' locker room games in their head that may have worked in World War II, but they're simply out of touch. And I think that a positive, tough-minded, realistic administration of young Americans that say to the rest of the world, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to be patsies. We're not going to disarm. But I think that would be such a refreshing voice. And I think the rest of the world's waiting for America, because most, you know, I've been around the world quite a bit, and since I got paroled, since I was able to leave the country, I've talked to a lot of European and Asian and African journalists, and I tell you, you ask them flat out, is there any hope from Europe or Asia or Africa? And they'll say, hell no. The only hope in the world is still America, because it's the only place where freedom and intelligence and individualism and immigration, we invite the smart people to come here. It's the only place that's happening. It's not happening anyplace else. So, yeah, these are my reasons for optimism, but I'm an activist optimist, and I'm out there sending this signal out and to, as I say, millions of people, and that's why I wrote this book. I'm going to write other books. I'm writing movies. I'm every possible transmitting a message of intelligent, scientific, activist optimism. Boy, that's a handful of big words, isn't it?
You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
Well, as far as being able to forecast the political landscape here in the States, I'm afraid that poor Timothy was far too optimistic. And even today, with young Mr. Obama in the White House, we see that the political enlightenment Dr. Leary so optimistically predicted just hasn't come to pass. But that says more about the system than it does about the people who bubble to its top. However, politics aside, I think the rest of his forecasting was right on the money. I know that you are aware of this, but I have to say it. Wasn't his rap near the end just now, when he was going on about the future importance of personal computers and networking, wasn't that amazing when you think of when he said it? That was back in 1983, when the IBM PC was just 1 year old and the web was still 9 years away. When you go back and listen to it again, try to keep that in mind. And I think you'll agree that Dr. Timothy Leary, if nothing else, was surely a good prophet, or futurist in today's lingo. By the way, if you want another take on the stories surrounding Leary's departure from Harvard, you might want to listen to one of my interviews with Myron Stolaroff. I think it was in Podcast 92, the last of the Lone Pine Stories programs, where he tells about being the person who actually broke the news about the imminent departure from Harvard to Leary's staff over dinner one night. It certainly puts another gloss on a tale that has as many facets as there were people involved. Also, in a couple of my interviews with Gary Fisher, he tells some interesting stories about his adventures with the good Dr. Leary and his merry little band as they were first kicked out of Mexico and then out of two Caribbean countries before winding up at Millbrook. And if you are interested in going back to one of those talks, just go to our blog at psychedelicsalon.org and click on the Gary Fisher category or do a search for him and Dr. Leary. And, of course, the same goes for finding other bits and pieces of these 180-plus podcasts that I've documented on that blog. Another interesting story about Dr. Leary can be heard on one of Douglas Rushkoff's recent radio programs. I might have missed this myself, but thankfully Ulysses S. sent me the information and a link to a conversation that Douglas had with counterculture heroine/outcast, Joanna Harcourt Smith, on his radio show, The Media Squat. And I'll try to remember to put a link to it in the program notes for today's podcast. But what makes this interview so intriguing is that Joanna candidly talks about her and Leary's role in becoming informants for the government, all in the context of Timothy's imprisonment and the Bush-style torture of him during the time he was being held a captive in Afghanistan. As Douglas says, there's some new material in here as well as a new perspective on a particularly dark moment. So, if, like me, you are interested in these things, you might want to surf over to Douglas's website and take a listen. Another website I'd like to plug is that of the uber geek and graphic artist, Stephen Rook. Now, if you have a copy of my book, The Spirit of the Internet, you already have a copy of one of Stephen's works of art, because I used it on the cover. I don't have time right now to go into the methodology involved in creating this art, but it's very intriguing. And for a little bit of tribal history, I might add that there was a magical night years ago when 100 or so of us were in Palenque and Stephen projected images of his work through a 35mm slide projector and onto the naked bodies of dozens of dancers. It was a spectacular show and one I hope to experience one day again. But if you do visit Stephen's website, be sure to read about how he created this art, or more accurately, how an artificial intelligence did it. And while I'm in the plugging mood, I want to point you to a couple of podcasts that I haven't mentioned for a while, but which are two of my favorites. One is the return appearance of the musical programs from Queer Ninja over on the Cannabis Podcast Network at dopefiend.co.uk. I've listened to his latest world music program at least 3 times now and plan on listening again. It's really great to have you back in cyberdelic space, Ninja, and thanks for getting back in the groove again. We all missed you. And then there is BB's Bungalow, which you will also find at dopefiend.co.uk. The other day I was cooking dinner, having a bag of vape, and listening to her 420 show, and I got to thinking about how nice it was to be able to enjoy sort of virtually hanging around her bungalow and listening to music and the conversation between her, SEB, and Queer Ninja. It really made me feel as if I wasn't celebrating 420 alone. And then, of course, I realized that it was already May, and I was listening to her podcast a couple of weeks late. And so I had 2 420 celebrations this year. Another thing I'd like to point out about that particular program of BB's, I think it's number 20, is that it gave me the impression that SEB, the Ninja, and BB were all sitting in the same room and having a conversation, when the fact was that BB was in Australia and her 2 companions were quite literally on the other side of the world because they were both in the UK. Now, even though we all seem to take things like this for granted today, just think back only, say, 5 years ago, and you'll remember that only big corporations with huge budgets could have pulled something like that off. Without paying much attention to it, our tech is rapidly changing the world. And I mean that quite literally. And you, my dear friend, are most definitely on the leading edge of this wave. So thanks for being a part of this continual unfolding of consciousness here in cyberdelic space. Finally, I'd like to pass along some news about the ongoing efforts to preserve as much of the historical record of our tribe as possible. To begin with, a fellow Saloner, William Rafty, has posted a 6-part interview with the Shulgans on YouTube. This is a recent interview that took place in Ann and Sasha's home and is very much worth watching. So, hey, thanks for doing that, William. Your work is very much appreciated. And the good news about the Shulgin and Stolaroff archives comes from John Hanna, who is one of the people deeply involved in these projects. We've exchanged a whole series of emails about this work when I asked him what they still needed in the way of resources to complete their project. And so, right now I'd like to read a few things he had to say. We don't have a minimum donation set up for the Stolaroff collection because we realized that any amount could really help with that project from a large number of folks. With the Shulgin collection, we did set a minimum donation, I think it was $500, and I am happy to say that enough money was raised to hire Paul to help Sasha working half-time for a year. So we are much less focused on raising money for that project at the moment and would prefer to plug funding for the Stolaroff collection work. And he goes on to say, I've already spent a bunch of time on the project on Arrowwood's dime without any real funding having come in yet for the work. Of course, they want to get it done, but unless we can generate some cash, the going will be quite slow. And then he sent me a URL where they've posted some information about this project, and I'll put that along with the program notes for this podcast. But here is some of what you'll find there. In 1961, Myron Stolaroff founded the International Foundation for Advanced Study in Menlo Park, conducting clinical investigations administering carbogen, LSD, or mescaline to hundreds of subjects. In 1965, the FDA began to revoke permits for human studies with psychedelics, forcing the conclusion of this research. Between 1970 and 1986, Myron conducted additional personal studies using unscheduled compounds. However, this work was stopped too with the passage of the Controlled Substance Analog Act of 1986. Arrowwood has just begun the process of sorting and cataloging Myron's vast treasure trove of letters, writings, and ephemera related to his research into the effects of psychoactive drugs on human consciousness, in order to prepare them for digitizing and publication online. But we need targeted funding to continue working on this archive, so please consider making a contribution to the Stolaroff Collection Project. We are seeking $10,000 to $15,000 for this project in 2009 to cover scanning and processing costs. Contributions made to support the Stolaroff Collection are earmarked for this project and are not used for the general support of Arrowwood. Donations are 100% tax deductible in the United States. Now, if you've been with us here in the salon for a while, you have no doubt heard my interviews with Myron, as well as the talk he gave on the occasion of Albert Hoffman's 100th birthday celebration. Sadly, due to Myron's battle with dementia, there won't be any more interviews with this important figure in our tribe's history. And so it seems to me that it is more important than ever that we preserve as much of his work as possible. Now, I've personally gone through quite a bit of this material, and I'm here to tell you that it is simply priceless. Granted, the 1,000 or so highly detailed experience reports about dozens and dozens of compounds are something that researchers today will find priceless, but to me, it's the personal correspondence between the Stolaroff, Shulgins, and the other pioneers back in the day that future historians are going to find invaluable in filling out the personal details of the lives of these pioneers of consciousness research. And by the way, John Hanna has already written one beautiful piece for the next issue of Arrowwood Extracts, which is Arrowwood's membership magazine. And in it, he describes the recent trip that he took with Sasha and Ann Shulgin to visit the Stolaroffs and to collect the materials. Now, I understand that issue of Extracts will be mailed out to the Arrowwood members in June. And the details of this trip he relates are really fascinating, along with some of the pictures he's included. As most of our fellow Saloners already know, this Arrowwood Extracts publication only comes out about twice a year, but I find it more than worth the $30 donation, which of course goes to keeping the Arrowwood site online. Now here are a few more thoughts from John Hanna, who says, "In any case, you might suggest that people donate whatever they can, but that donations of $25 or more will really help to get some hours clocked on the project. We also already have the first small fruit from the collection posted online, a few DMT trip reports from Al Hubbard, circa 1961. And during May, those reports can be located from the Arrowwood homepage at arrowwood.org, that's E-R-O-W-I-D.org, simply by clicking on the Arrowwood Monthly link. Ultimately, it is going to take about $10,000 to complete the scanning aspect of archiving the Stolaroff collection. And while every donation of any amount helps, and a lot of small donations of $10 to $25 will add up, we can really get the project rolling if a few people gave somewhat larger donations. And by the way, if you follow the link I put on the program notes, you'll go to the page where the Stolaroff collection is posted, and you can make a donation, tax-deductible donation right there. Now, since this is a new call for help, and since we have received so many donations to the salon this past week, I feel like I should let all of our donors know that if you would like for me to send all or part of your donations to the salon on to the Stolaroff project, I'll be more than happy to do so. After all, we're all in this together, you know. But the real bottom line here is that after spending the past several years working with Myron's family to try and preserve his records, that I am overjoyed at the progress that John and all of the other people involved in this project are making. And one day, a few centuries from now, my guess is that there will probably be more people reading through the papers of the Shulgins, Stolaroffs, and other psychedelic pioneers than there are people going through the records in any of the presidential libraries. This is really important work that the Arrowwood team has undertaken, and the fruits of their labors are going to be available on the internet for all the world to share. So thanks in advance for whatever help you can give. And hey, I realize that most of our fellow saloners aren't in a position to help financially right now, but just by surfing over to arrowwood.org and looking through some of these interesting records lets us know that this work is not in vain. So don't feel bad if you can't send a few bucks their way. Just send some more people their way instead. It all helps. And now I guess it would help if I would just quit talking. So I'll close today's podcast by reminding you once again that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are freely available for you to use in your own audio projects under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And that's also where you'll find the program notes for these podcasts. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.